regular listeners, it's nice to have you with us. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are indeed in Christmas times. I hope that you're comfortable wherever you are in the world, and that you've had a nice December solstice, as we up here in the Northern Hemisphere, at least, are moving slowly towards lighter and warmer times. And today we are going to follow up on the UFO theme here on the program. And in the first part, we are going to primarily discuss the validity of the MJ-12 documents. MJ-12, for those of you who don't know, stands for the basically the Majestic 12 Group. It's the code name of a secret committee of scientists, military leaders, and government officials, supposedly formed in 1947 by an executive order of U.S. President Harry S. Truman. The purpose of the committee was to investigate UFO activity in the aftermath of the Roswell incident. And we have author and retired soldier Kevin Randall with us on the program today to talk about this and much more. He's written Case MJ-12, Roswell Revisited, Project Blue Book Exposed, just to name a few of his titles. He also has a new book coming out called Crash that goes more into the details of the UFO crashes throughout history. And this is something that we'll go more into a little bit later in the program. His blog is called A Different Perspective, and you can get to it by going to kevinrandle.blogspot.com. That's Kevin, RANDLE.blogspot.com. So with that, welcome to Red Ice Radio, and thank you for joining us today on the program, Kevin.
Delighted to join you.
It's good to have you here, and why don't we begin to just talk a little bit about yourself, Kevin, some of your background, and let us know how long have you been into the UFO theme, and how long have you been interested in the subject, Kevin?
I think my interest in UFOs started when I was a kid. I saw a movie called Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, which was very loosely based on a book by Don Kehoe, which was an alien invasion type thing with the flying saucers. And from that point, I became very interested in the topic, reading what I could find and listening to what I could hear on the radio or watching on television. And it blossomed from there. And the one thing that always bothered me, at least when I was young, was it seemed that the UFO sightings that were being discussed, the flying saucer sightings, were a vague craft with indistinct outlines. And a friend of mine's mother had seen a UFO some years before, and I had an opportunity to interview her and get her opinion, and found out that she had seen the thing from fairly close up. It had very distinct edges. It was a very distinct object. It wasn't this blurred thing that I'd been led to believe. And from that point on, I just became much more interested, had an opportunity to investigate some cases. With my military experience, moving around the United States, I had a chance to get to places I wouldn't normally have gotten to and talk to witnesses, talk to people involved in various aspects of the UFO field. And from there, it just kind of bludgeoned into a work that took me all around the United States to investigate the Roswell case, to investigate other UFO sightings, a UFO crash in the Las Vegas area, and talking to contactees and abductees around the country. So it's been a long series of investigations that I have participated in, not just watching or reading about stuff, but actually going out and meeting the people who are involved in the sightings.
And in terms of your military background, was this anything that you've got into, so to speak, because of some of the activities in the military, or are these very separate? How does that work, Kevin?
I was always interested in this before I got into the military, and the military provided me with an opportunity to investigate cases I probably wouldn't have been able to investigate simply because of the distances involved or the timing. And because of that, I was able to investigate the cases, but it had nothing to do with the military. When I worked as an intelligence officer for the Air Force, I often looked for UFO sightings, found very few. There was something that was called the Weekly Intelligence Brief, which was a classified document. I think it was secret. But parts of it were unclassified, and I remember seeing one or two UFO sightings in there, and they were always unclassified, and it was merely sort of an oddity type thing. You know, this flight crew saw this at some point. Never anything very spectacular. So my investigations of UFOs while serving as a military officer was simply sort of a hobby that I was engaged in while serving in the military. It was not part of my military duties at all.
Were you involved in any regard to the with the disclosure project? Did you do any testimonies or something like that in there?
I'm not a big fan of Project Disclosure, simply because they don't vet the witnesses. They take anybody who has a story and run with it. And one of the best examples of this is the fellow, he was a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, who talked about seeing classified documents coming through his message center in the 1950s, talking about a crashed flying saucer up on Spitsbergen Island. And great, that's wonderful, except I've got copies of the documents. And what it was is a report that had come out of a couple of newspapers, I think in Germany, began in Germany and talked about this crash on Spitsbergen Island. But it turned out to be a hoax. It was a hoax that started out as it was some kind of a Russian craft that had been found and eventually sort of evolved into being an alien craft. So the guy was telling the truth. He had seen the documents. He'd seen classified messages about this crash coming through his comm center, but it turned out to be a hoax. And that was always my complaint. You know, okay, this is great. We talked to this guy, but we have a solution for that particular case. So it didn't do us any good. It didn't advance our knowledge. It didn't move us toward disclosure. So I've never really done anything at disclosure. I have talked to Dr. Greer a couple of times, and we have been at odds on a couple of the value of certain witnesses at times, but I've really not had anything to do with it.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit of your overall background, so to speak, when it comes to ufology. You have an article up on your blog right now in terms of the different factions, I guess we can call it, that exist out there. We have believers, we have debunkers, and the skeptics and so forth. And where do you come from in terms of ufology, Kevin?
Well, that came out of an idea. It always bothered me that on the far side of the spectrum, we have the skeptics, which is a very rational position to take, meaning, well, I look at the evidence, I am not completely convinced that there's anything to the UFO field, but I'm willing to investigate or willing to listen to it. To the debunkers, who really should be called deniers, because they deny that this possibly happened. There can be no UFO sightings, therefore there are no UFO sightings. And we move to the other end of the spectrum. We have the believers, which pretty much embrace everything that comes out of the UFO field. Yes, the contactees, some of them were telling the truth. Yes, we believe in all these various crashes from around the world. Yes, we believe the United States military got into a big dogfight with UFOs in 1952. They embrace everything. But for those of us who accept that some UFOs are extraterrestrial, there really wasn't a label for us. We got lumped into the believers, and I was kind of trying to come up with a word that we could use for us, and I suggested UFO supporters, meaning we support the idea that UFOs may be interplanetary ships or interstellar ships, and run with it from there. I think Jerry Clark suggested proponents as a better word. So I was just kind of looking at that, but we've always had this spectrum in the world of UFOs of moving from the deniers, debunkers on one side to the true believers on the other side. I kind of fall into the middle of this, still looking for the absolute proof that some UFOs are extraterrestrial. I believe that some UFOs are extraterrestrial based on my research into Roswell and my discussions with the military officers who were involved there and other things that I have seen. And in fact, Edwin Easley, who was the provost marshal at the Roswell Army Airfield in 1947, that being provost marshal being like the chief of police, he commanded the MP company and a special service squadron, which was also military police. He told me personally that when I asked him if we were following the right path, meaning we thought it was extraterrestrial, he said, well, let me put it this way, that's not the wrong path. In essence, telling us, yes, what fell at Roswell was extraterrestrial. Well, this is very persuasive evidence for me from a fellow who I contacted. He didn't come out looking for us. I contacted him. So I look at that sort of thing. So I'm not really a true believer because I don't accept a lot of the stuff. But by the same token, I accept some of it, suggesting that there's been interstellar visitation.
So
that was kind of where that blog piece came from.
I see, and I do want to talk obviously more about the Roswell case later on. And we have, as our listeners are familiar with, we have different obviously classifications in terms of reports and so forth. We have the abduction phenomena on one end of the spectrum. We have just the close encounters as well. But in your view, what would you define then as a credible sighting, so to speak? Are there a few examples out there, Kevin, that you would put higher up on the scale, so to speak, in terms of credibility?
Of course, Roswell is up there very high. I think of the Washington National sightings. These were the UFO sightings that took place over two consecutive weekends in July of 1952 over Washington, D.C., as being very credible because of the number of witnesses. We have instrumentality involved. The objects were seen on radar, and when the radar operators saw them and talked to either airline crews or military interceptor pilots, were able to vector them toward the lights that they saw, that the objects were seen on more than one radar set at more than one location, so it's not an abnormality on that specific radar set, are very credible. Look at those sources. I think the Belgium sightings in 1989, 1990, where we have a variety of very high-ranking Belgian military officers and a lot of people in that area seeing UFOs as being very credible as well. So we have those sorts of things going on. And there was a French wave in 1954 where there were an awful lot of sightings of creatures and that sort of thing that strike a chord with me as well. So it's, you know, that kind of a worldwide phenomenon, as I'm sure you're well aware of, in sightings that have multiple witnesses, that have some sort of instrumentality involved, that have movie footage, the Great Falls, Montana movie from 1950. In fact, Barry Greenwood did a wonderful article about how long the film was and whether or not the Air Force actually had removed frames from the film before it was released in the public arena, as the photographer had suggested, and was able to demonstrate that yes, a long section of film had been removed, which would have shown the objects much closer in a much more circular saucer shape. So there's lots of those kinds of things out there. What we get lost in is all the noise, the hoaxes, the misidentifications, and when you look at all of that stuff, you say, well, there's nothing to it because we've solved all these cases. But there's always this residue of very good cases. And what we find is that the longer the object is seen and the higher the educational level of the observer, the more likely that case is going to be unidentified, which makes perfect sense when you think about it. So there's a residue of very, very good cases from around the world that fit into that.
Mm. And again, it's a bit of a fuzzy area, just as you outline here, when it comes to UFOs, because we have another alternative here as well, which is in regards to what is being done here on Earth in terms of alternative propulsion systems, and it is being discussed that some of the sightings might be military testing new crafts and so forth. What's your take on all of that, Kevin?
I think there's no doubt that some UFO sightings are explainable by military aircraft. I've seen a segment of film of the F-117, which was the stealth fighter craft, taken from a specific angle and looked all the world like a dome disc on a triangular landing gear about to set down on Earth. And clearly, as you watch more of the film, And of course, we're told where the film came from, so we know this. This is a stealth fighter, and I think that sort of thing, the stealth bomber and other military aircraft as they're being developed, may account for that. The SR-71, which is 1950s technology when you think about it, we still don't know how fast that thing goes because that information is classified. But I do know that it was fast enough to outrun air-to-air missiles, which means it's going at Mach 3 or 4 at a minimum. Hmm. And we still don't know what the capabilities of that aircraft were, and there's obviously other military aircraft on the drawing boards of various countries around the world that, seen under the right circumstances, would certainly give rise to UFO sightings.
Absolutely. And in terms of, as you mentioned there, in the SR-71, the Blackbird, it's 1950s, 60s technology. What do you think is in the pipeline today, going towards 2010 now? What do you think is potentially in development, and what could that look like in terms of if we saw it out in the sky today, Kevin?
There are talks of diamond-shaped craft or triangular-shaped craft being developed as the new fighters. And you take a look at some of the concepts that we see based on what aviation writers have observed and what their speculations are and that sort of thing. Then when we start talking about triangular-shaped craft, we may be talking, at least in part, about seeing some of the advances in our technology, meaning Earth-based technology. And people wouldn't be familiar with that shape for aircraft. I mean, you look at an aircraft, it either has to have wings or a rotor blade, and now we're talking to something that's kind of all molded together, so the whole thing is kind of a lifting body. So that could lead to some UFO sightings. But that certainly doesn't account for the sightings over populated areas, because you don't test the next generation of military aircraft, for the most part, over populated areas. You don't test them over the countries, because if something goes wrong and the craft falls to the ground there, well, then that country has gained that technology for whatever reason. So you're very careful on where you test it. Given all of that, and we take a look at the UFO sightings that have been made, clearly military aircraft don't account for all of them.
Exactly. And some of these crafts, they have other features that potentially put them out of the human development area, so to speak. We can talk about glowing, everything from glowing spheres to those who seem to hover silently, and even the size of the crafts play into this as well.
Are their ability to make nearly right angle turns without killing the occupants inside? And so the maneuverability takes it outside the realm of what our current technology, and by that I mean 2009, 2010 technology, certainly takes it outside the capability of our technologies.
Absolutely. And these are some of the things that we obviously want to discuss here as well a little bit later. Just as a tidbit here, I would like to ask you, since you're involved in this, the Norway blue spiral that came and popped up here a few days ago, it's claimed that it was a failed Russian missile test and so forth. Have you looked into anything of this, Kevin? And if so, what's your take on all of this?
I have looked at it a little bit. In fact, there's a video bar on my blog, and I don't really control what shows up on the video bar other than it's UFO-related. And so I've noticed that a couple of times footage from that has shown up on the video bar. So I've looked at the footage, and I've seen some of the debates in the various news groups around the world, as a matter of fact. Don Ledger from Canada, for example, is very vocal on this. And I think one or two people from New Zealand weighed in on it. So a number of people are on it. It seems to be a failed rocket test. I think the rational end of the UFO believers seem to accept the explanation that it's a failed Russian test. And I have no reason to doubt that solution for that particular sighting. There was also on the internet not long ago a bolide that fell near Trinidad, Colorado, that was caught on a couple of police car video cameras, which is just absolutely fascinating, because you see the streak of light, and then the thing explodes in a big flash of light, and it just lights everything up like daylight and fades out immediately, and that showed up. But it's pretty clear that was a bolide as well, because you can see it coming in, and it probably struck the ground somewhere in Utah, which would be west of Trinidad, Colorado.
Hmm. There you go. And what would you say in terms of, I mean, again, there's so many videos out there now with YouTube and all the other video hosting sites that are up there continuously. There's a current of new videos coming out all the time. Would you say that along with new videos and so forth, there has to follow along some kind of eyewitness or some kind of testimony in order to even make it valid? Or do you have some kind of, easy way on how you, validate all these new videos that are coming out, Kevin?
In today's world, where every teenager has at his fingertips or her fingertips basically a Hollywood studio and editing bay, can make a very dramatic video that is nearly inexplicable. In fact, Russ Estes, who was a good friend of mine, had a huge editing bay, and he made one of these videos to show me how easy it was, but he made sure the UFO in it was so incredibly animated that no one would take it for real in case somebody stumbled onto it. But he showed me how easy it was to do this. So in today's world, we need to have not only the videotape or the video record of it, but we also have to have some sort of independent corroboration, some independent witnesses from those separated from those who made the footage. And if we had the footage from two or three angles, then we'd have a wonderful record, because then we could do a lot of things with the analysis of the videos, given where they were when they took them. So we could triangulate, get an idea of distance, get an idea of size, get an idea of speed, something that would be very, very important to us. Mm. Back in the 50s, when the Montana movie was made, for example, you couldn't do that on your home computer. You had to have, in essence, a Hollywood studio to be able to fake something like that. So in that arena, you can say, well, that's a very credible piece of film, even though we only have two witnesses involved in it. In today's world, we've got to have much more, and we've got to be able to corroborate it through outside and independent sources. I think in scientific investigation, we call that multiple chains of evidence. So we have one chain, which would be the eyewitness testimony, one chain would be the videotape, and one chain would be the analysis of the tape. And if it left some kind of a trace on the ground, that would be a third chain of evidence. And we to build the perfect UFO case, we're going to have those multiple chains of evidence to get there. One person coming forward with a tape or a DVD of a UFO in today's world is not going to do it, simply because that is very easily faked today. We've got to have those multiple chains of evidence to make it a viable case.
Absolutely. And, there's a lot of talks of disclosure today, and it has been for a while, though, and obviously, same as it ever was in that regard, nothing seems to be happening. I just want to get your take on this in terms of if you ever think that there will be some kind of official disclosure taking place from, government officials, military, or something of the ilk. And, of course, this dovetails a little bit with MJ-12 that we're going to go into here a little bit later, but in terms of official disclosure coming from the authorities, so to speak. Do you think that that's something that ever will happen, Kevin?
I think it's going to be precipitated by some event. If there's going to be some UFO-related event that's going to precipitate disclosure, something they cannot control. That being said, the idea of disclosure goes back to the 1950s, and there's actually rumors, or were rumors, or have been rumors, there's been discussion that the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, not the latest version, but the 1950 version by Robert Wise starring Michael Rennie, was their first attempt to move toward the disclosure by showing the aliens as sort of our benevolent big brothers, if you will. And that was going to lead to the government coming out with, and when I say government, the U.S. government coming out saying, well, yes, this is what we found about UFOs, this is what we know about flying saucers. And since that time, there have been discussions of disclosure time and time again. The J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, the people there, Mark Rodiker, Don Schmidt, and those guys have told me that at one point, around the time that Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out, that there was a call into the Senate that said, disclosure is at hand. Dr. Hynek, you need to go down to the studio. They'll be waiting for you because we're going to do disclosure here, and we'd like to have your take on it. And Hynek went down there, and, of course, the disclosure never came about. So this idea of disclosure has been coming about or been talked about for quite a long time. The problem is, and you have to get into the military mindset to kind of understand this and how it works in a classification field, where I investigate a UFO sighting, I classify it. Now, I control that specific information. The aliens, of course, can land at any time they want and disprove what I'm saying, that there's no such thing. But the military mindset is such that we're going to classify this until such time as that position becomes untenable. In the 1960, I think it was, President Eisenhower said that we are not flying U-2 aircraft over the Soviet Union for purposes of spying. It doesn't happen. And they denied us, even though they knew they had lost a U-2, and they knew that the pilot might have been captured, but they were denying that this was taking place, even though they knew it was. And I think that's kind of where we are with the UFO field. The government, the U.S. government, the British government, the Swedish government, the government seemed to be saying, well, there's nothing to this. It does not impact our national security. And they can keep saying that until the aliens prove otherwise. And that strategy has worked from 1947 till today. So it's worked for more than 60 years. And that's the military mindset. You don't worry about what the other guy can do. You worry about what you can control. You control what you can control and hope for the best.
And you do that in order to have that control, to possess that control, so to speak, I guess, then in one way. Because as a follow-up question to that, I kind of want to ask you, why you think the reason would be to hold it back? Are we potentially talking about something that is malevolent here, or is there any other reason, do you think, that the official governments don't want to talk openly about this because they simply don't know what's going on yet and they haven't kind of assessed the situation yet, if you know what I mean?
I believe that the U.S. government knows exactly what's going on. And I believe this because they picked one up in 1947. The Roswell crash was an alien spacecraft. They knew exactly what they had once they got the debris, once they found the craft, once they found the bodies. They knew it was, I believe, that at that time their thinking would have been interplanetary as opposed to interstellar, but they knew it was not from this Earth. I believe that the U.S. government was thinking, if we can reverse engineer this, we've now taken a huge step technologically over the rest of the world and our major competitors, which of course at the time would have been the Soviet Union. We don't want to give the Soviet Union this technology. They could control that, and everybody says, well, that doesn't make sense because there could have been a crash somewhere else. Yeah, there could have been, but at that point there hadn't been. They controlled that, and if they can convince people it didn't happen, they don't have to worry about espionage, because who's going to send out an espionage team or spies to look into something that never happened? So they can control the information that way. Why that persists today, I don't understand. In 1947, it kind of made sense because, well, we'd had the ghost rockets in Scandinavia, as you well know, which was a bunch of UFO sightings, that they sent Jimmy Doolittle to investigate to see if there was something to that. Then we have the sightings in 1947 in the United States and then kind of scattered around the world. But people weren't really sure what was going on. Well, Roswell told them what was going on, but it happened in the United States. It happened in an environment that the government could control. Had the object fallen near New York City or Washington, D.C., they could have never controlled it. But if it fell in the middle of New Mexico in a very desolate area, and the stuff was taken to a military town, which could in essence control the media, which they did. And so the secret persisted from that point on. Why it persists today, I don't know, because we're much more sophisticated. We're involved in searches for extrasolar planets. There was a discussion in National Geographic magazine about super-Earths, which are rocky planets orbiting various stars I think the last one they found is about 2.5 times the size of Earth, and they believe it is covered in oceans, although it's somewhat warmer than Earth would be. But here's a planet where life certainly could generate.
Mm.
So we're beginning to understand all of that, and we're much more sophisticated. So there wouldn't be the sort of negative reaction you would expect. But the other thing that I'm aware of is that when a technologically superior civilization comes in contact with a technologically inferior civilization, the technologically inferior civilization ceases to exist. Not necessarily through conquest, not necessarily through war, but simply the introduction of that technology radically alters the society.
Mm.
And we can look at the various areas of Earth where that has happened.
Yes.
One of the best examples is the Spanish introduction of the horse to the New World and changed the way the Plains Indians lived. The horse became extremely important to their culture and changed their culture radically. So that might be why it persists, because if they begin to talk about this, it may alter our society in some way they can't predict, and that frightens them. I really have no good answer for that question.
So that's interesting. It's almost like what you're describing there is a microcosm version of what we might be looking at if we think about this in the terms of our potential neighbors then. And with that, having said that, there are some theories out there that even the transistor and eventually even the microchip then actually have come from back engineering various crafts that have crashed here on Earth. What's your take on that, Kevin?
With this transistor, I think the history of the transistor is pretty well established, so that there's no quantum leap in the technology that you would expect. And in fact, if we trace an awful lot of the technological steps we have taken, we can see there's no sudden quantum leap in our knowledge. There's a very precise evolution of this. Which is not to say that could not happen. I think about this in the way of us not being able to understand the science and the technology that was found at Roswell. It would be like taking a DVD player back to Merlin the Magician, and you say to him, duplicate this. Well, to do that, he's got to understand lasers. He's got to understand electricity. He's got to understand magnetism. Some things that are invisible and unknown at the time. And it would have taken literally hundreds of years for the Earth-based technology, his technology, to evolve to the point where he could understand what a DVD player was. Because you take a silver disc and you can translate it to pictures and sound, but how do you get to that point? And I'm thinking that maybe the technology that was picked up at Roswell is that kind of a quantum leap, that we do not have the scientific understanding at this point that we can solve the problems and back engineer this and have this filter into our technology. On the other hand, we can take a look at how has the internet changed society, where you could have a very you could have a society that was very closed, that relied on itself, and now I find I have colleagues throughout the world that I communicate with almost instantaneously through the internet. And so that's really altered our societies and our cultures today, although it's a slow evolution. And that may be another problem. You know, they're worried about these sorts of things changing our society. But I haven't seen any scientific development, any technological development that would suggest a quantum leap, that somebody took something and created something that was so far afield that there is no evolution to that point.
Mm. Do you think that could be the case in terms of the Roswell incident, for instance, then, that they are in possession of a craft and certain technology there, but they haven't been able to, if you will, crack the code of the craft yet?
That's the only explanation I can think. Although we do see some composites and our radar, radar invisible craft that we are now building, may have been suggested by the Roswell craft, but it is those sorts of small things that we've been able to solve. And it may be, what if the society we're dealing with, the alien society, communicates on a mental level as opposed to the way we do through speech, and so that they're not really thinking things, but they're all sort of part of one giant organism. And so all their knowledge is carried basically in all of them at all times, so they have no need to write stuff down. So they have no information retrieval systems, because all the information they need is always at their fingertips because of this mental contact they are with everybody. So those sorts of things might give rise to a way of doing things that we would never think of, because we have the need to participate in information retrieval. If I want to know something, I can't just think about it and someone else kind of thinks the answer at me. I've got to go search it out, whether it be on the internet or the library or through books. I have to go search for the answers, because we have information retrieval. But think how society would change if we didn't have to do that sort of thing, and what that might mean to how we all treated one another, as opposed to the way we treat each other now.
Hmm. So what do you think, before again we go into the MG-12 documents here in specifics, Kevin, what do you think we're faced with here in terms of the overarching situation, in terms of our potential neighbors or wherever they come from? Are they extraterrestrial? Is it one race? Is it multiples? Are they, as you suggested, millions of years maybe even ahead of us technologically speaking? What's your take on all this?
Well, given the vastness of the galaxy, just given that, it would seem to suggest there's probably only one set of visitors. But if you're an intelligent spacefaring race and you're out there looking, you may have found other intelligences. So that ups the ante. There could be more. I personally think that we're talking about extraterrestrial entities, people, creatures, intelligence on other worlds coming to Earth. There's always the possibility, although I believe it to be very small, that we're dealing with time travelers from Earth's future. There may be interdimensional travel of some kind, because now we're talking about multiverses as opposed to a single universe, but a multiverse. So it may be creatures in another universe have unlocked the secret to the doorways into our universe. So there's all kinds of answers. The most logical to me is extraterrestrial, meaning that we have visitors from another world. I would suspect that world is close to our planet simply because of the vast distances, but they may have found a way of defeating that, and then a trip to our solar system from across the galaxy might be easier than a trip to the nearest star, simply in the same way you might think of a trip from New York City to a smaller town in the United States can become very cumbersome, because you have to take all these intermediate stops to get there, where a direct flight from Los Angeles or Copenhagen or Oslo would be much, much easier, because you can fly direct. Mm. So I don't really have enough information to make an intelligent guess, other than to say, I limit it because of these things, but those limitations may be inaccurate.
Mm. What do you think their interest is in us and Earth? Is it scientific or is it conquest oriented?
Given the timing, meaning if we go back and use 1947 as the date of the beginning of the modern era, or go back to 1946 as the beginning of the modern era, or look at the Foo Fighters from World War II as the beginning of the modern era, we're looking at a period of time of 60, 70 years. That would suggest that the interest is scientific more than conquest, because they certainly could have initiated the conquest long ago. And in today's world, it might be much more costly for them to invade than it would have been in 1950, because the state of our technology is advanced. The state of our ability to get off the Earth has advanced, and the destructive capability of our weapons has advanced, if you can say that that is an advancement. But so it looks to me more like it's scientific interest, and I would think that if the situation was reversed, meaning that we had found an industrial society on another world that was about to move into the space age, we would take a profound interest in them. And we would probably visit that world a little bit more often than we might visit other worlds just to watch their progress and see how their society evolves. So I would speculate that their interest would be scientific, that their interest is somewhat benign as opposed to benevolent, because they're certainly doing nothing for us, but they're not doing anything to really harm us either. So it's more benign than anything else. That would be my guess.
Okay, and would you say that this then incorporates the abduction phenomena, or do you think that that's something completely different going on?
I believe that the solution of the abduction phenomena is trustworthy based, meaning that if there are any abductions, they're very, very few and far between, and that what we're looking at as the abduction phenomenon, which doesn't make me very popular in the UFO field, but if what we're looking at in the abduction phenomena is probably a number of different terrestrially based problems, that there is no single solution to it. There's multiple solutions, but everybody is looking for a single one that covers all the facts, and I don't think that's going to happen. So the abduction phenomenon, if you take the abduction phenomena and accept it as based in reality, then it's certainly not benign, and in fact is somewhat harmful. I don't believe it's malevolent, but it would be somewhat harmful.
Mm.
But that's if you accept it as being conducted by alien creatures, and then at least in the United States, it boils down to which researchers' information do you accept? Do you accept Bud Hopkins, who has the cold calculating scientific entities doing their experiments, or the David Jacobs theory that they're actually attempting to interbreed with the human race and create a hybrid race that can inhabit our planet?
Right.
Or the John Matt philosophy, where they sort of had an Eastern philosophy of nonviolent Eastern philosophy. So it all kind of related to, in the United States, which researcher had been conducting the research and what information he, and in some cases she, had gathered.
Yeah, and is there any one of these that you favor? I mean, we had David Jacobs on the program, and we talked about his research, and that was, horrifying to say the least in that sense. And what's your take on his research? If that is true, that's a horrific picture that he paints there.
I think I would throw in with the Bud Hopkins that David Jacobs has taken it a little bit too far. One of the things that we noticed, and John Mack had pointed this out originally, that it was interesting that the abductee experience sort of mirrored the belief structure of the researcher. In other words, those who believe in the cold calculating scientists always seem to end up with Bud Hopkins, and those who believed in the hybrid system always seem to end up with David Jacobs, and those who believed in the Eastern philosophy always seemed to end up with John Mack. And Mack said in his book that he and C.D. Bryant's book on the MIT abduction, I think it's on page 273 of the hardback edition, Mack was discussing this and how they had kicked this around. And I kind of reversed that and said, could it be that the researcher is subtly implanting his or her belief structures on the abductee and getting to that point?
Mm.
And if you look at some of what Jacobs has done, he talks in the thread about a woman who came to him and believed that she had sort of a guardian angel, and the guardian angels were these alien creatures who were interacting with her in the abduction phenomenon. And after he had conducted some 30 or 40 hypnosis sessions with her, hypnotic regressions with her, she came around to believe that they weren't all that friendly and they weren't all that nice, and it became frightening. And I'm thinking, this is very illustrative of the problems with hypnotic regression and that sort of thing, but we have a subtle implantation of ideas by the researchers. I don't think they're consciously doing anything, but they're looking for specific things. And if you look at the transcripts of, as they have published them, you can see the subtle implantation of the ideas, where they say, you put somebody in hypnotic regression, and they say, well, I don't really remember anything. It's, well, yes, you can, and we'll go a little deeper, and we'll look a little harder, and do you remember something like this, or did something like this happen? And eventually you get to the point where that individual is relating to the researcher what he or she wants to hear. And you have to look at all this stuff very carefully. Hypnosis is not a good way of doing it. So the abduction phenomena is badly flawed because of that. And Russ Estes, Bill Cohn, Dr. Cohn, who is a clinical psychologist, and I did a book called The Abduction Enigma 12 years ago, and we suggested ways of improving the research so we could answer some of these questions. But today, the research seems to be conducted in the same ways. We haven't changed anything, and we haven't advanced anywhere.
Hmm. Well, that's an interesting point, absolutely. And it seems to me as well then that the phenomena overall seems to be more of a relationship with the human being, the belief of the human beings who are studying it as well then, and depending on your perspective, as you outlined, it will take a different shape. So it seems to be very difficult to come to some kind of, if you will, objective truth, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. The problem is, there's a number of problems, actually. One of the problems is the egos of the researchers, so that their belief structure gets in way of accepting information and evidence. And I'm as guilty of that as anybody, although I try to overlook it. And one of the best examples is the idea of a crash on the plains of San Augustine. And Stan Friedman and I had a number of discussions or little skirmishes about this. And one of the points that he made in what he called was a false claim by me, that I said there had been archaeologists on the plains of San Augustine in July of 1947 who would have seen the crash over on the plains had it happened. And he said none of them were there at the time. Well, we found documentation that put one of the guys there on the 1st of July in the Bat Cave, which is on the eastern side of the plains of San Augustine. And I sent this information to Stan, and he wrote back, well, we don't know how deep in the cave they were, and we don't know which way the cave faces, and we don't know all this stuff. And it wasn't, oh, my gosh, there was somebody there. What did he tell us? It was, here's the reasons he couldn't have seen anything. And if you're looking at human habitation in a cave, you're not going very deep into it, because the human habitation is usually in the very entrance of the cave, the where they can see out. They'll get light from the daylight. From the sun. But the other thing was, the evidence in this report that came out from Harvard University, I believe, and a letter the guy wrote in December of 1947, said that they had camped 150 yards from the entrance to the cave, and they had a panoramic view of the plains all the way from the south to the north to Daddle. So they had a panoramic view of the plains the whole time they were there. And yet Stan's response was, this is interesting, what does it tell us? His response was, well, they might not have seen anything because of this, this, and this. Well, all of those questions have been answered, and had something fallen on the plains of San Augustine in early July of 1947, these guys should have seen it, and they did not. So we have a problem with the idea that the Roswell crash was two things colliding, one falling near Corona and one falling on the plains of San Augustine. Hmm. But the ego, Stan's ego in this case, was such that he was looking for excuses not to accept the information rather than looking at all the information and saying, this is very good. I'm as guilty of that as he is. I mean, I can say, well, when people came to me and told me why Frank Kaufman shouldn't be believed, I was looking for reasons to believe Frank Kaufman rather than looking at the evidence that suggested maybe Frank Kaufman wasn't telling us the truth. And we eventually learned through a preponderance of evidence, it was undeniable that Frank Kaufman was not telling us the truth about his involvement in the Roswell case. So we need to, you know, it's not just abductions, but it's throughout the field. We've got to get to the point where we look at the evidence and see what the evidence tells us, as opposed to seeing what we'd like the evidence to tell us. And and that's sort of invaded the entire field.
Well, very good point, and obviously very, very interesting. And I think, Kevin, what we can do here now is actually begin to round things up here for the first hour and then continue talking more in the second hour for our members. This has given us a very good background picture, so to speak, that you've painted for us for the, in terms of the problematics, if you will, as well, of the UFO study, basically. And in the next segment here, I want to go then in more detailed into MJ-12 specifically, going to Roswell a little bit more, and also talk more about your book, Crash. But I think maybe to round things up here for the first segment, maybe you can mention your website for us, and also some of the titles that you have out there for people who want to dig deeper into some of these subjects and maybe find out your take and some of your research, not only in terms of Roswell, but also the MJ-12 documents, Kevin.
I know if you type a different perspective, UFO, into a Google search engine, you'll get to my website. There's, if you type a different perspective, which is the title of it, you end up with a number of different things like that, and you have to go down a ways to get to my blog. But a different perspective, UFO, gets you to my blog, but it's also www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com. And it started out to be a look at a lot of different things. There was early on, there was some articles about Anastasia, the woman who claimed to have survived the assassination of the Tsar in Russia in 1917, this Anna Anderson. There was a discussion about the Bermuda Triangle, the Allende letter. So it had evolved into looking at all these sorts of esoteric things. And lately, I noticed it's been an awful lot of stuff on Roswell, long discussions on what happened in Socorro in 1964. But we try to move about and look at a lot of different things. So it's looking at that. I've done, I did the first UFO book I did was called the UFO Casebook. Then there was UFO Crash at Roswell. I did The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell with Don Schmidt, A History of UFO Crashes, Conspiracy of Silence, Project Moondust, Scientific Ufology, which looks at a way of studying UFOs with the scientific method instead of a rejection of it. I did the Roswell Encyclopedia, which was just a big book about the various components of the Roswell case and looking at all of that. And the new book coming out in the spring is called Crash, and it's a look at UFO crash study stories, starting with France in 840 AD, moving up to an event that took place in Ottawa, Canada, in 2009. So it's a 1,200-year look at the UFO crashes, or the stories of UFO crashes, and what the solutions might be.
Very interesting. Let's talk a little bit more about that in our next hour as well. But again, the website is kevinrandall.blogspot.com. We will have this linked up on redicecreations.com as well. Stay with us, Kevin. Thank you for this first hour. We'll take a short break and we'll continue talking after this. That's our first hour with Kevin Randall. We'll go into detail about the MJ-12 documents in hour two. We talk about the people involved in bringing forward the documents. We talk about the military generals that was mentioned to have been involved in Majestic. We talk about Kevin's research and his thesis that the documents are fraudulent. We talk about legitimate military investigations of the UFO phenomena and some of the different consequent projects like Sign, Saucer, Grudge, Blue Book, and also Project Moondust and Blue Fly. We talk more about the Roswell crash and bodies found there. We talk about other UFO crashes throughout history. One from France back in 1840 AD, and all the way up to events in Las Vegas, in Kecksburg, in Canada at Shag Harbor, and other sightings like the Phoenix Lights. Don't forget to check out our premiere of Red Eyes TV. Our first episode is on 2012. Links are available on our website, redicecreations.com. Thank you for listening, and we here from Red Eyes say Merry Christmas to all our listeners. Join us for much more in our next hour with Kevin Randall.